IU grad workers go on strike. A court okays Indiana's two primary rule for party affiliation. Plus, Brent Waltz pleads guilty and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 15th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana University graduate workers in Bloomington went on strike for union recognition. Due to weather conditions, in-person events were postponed on the strike's first day. Instead, graduate workers met on Zoom to kick it off before the official strike got underway. Graduate student Valentina Luceda says the planned picket line showed the university that graduate workers are willing to fight for their rights.
They want us to remain quiet. They want us to remain in line. And they want us to remain separate from each other. What we're doing, what we have been doing, or what we're going to do on this picket line tomorrow is come together.
The strike will currently last a week, but could be extended. IU spokesperson Chuck Carney said the school is disappointed by the decision to strike. After listening sessions, IU recently gave graduate workers a 5% raise, but has no plans to recognize the graduate workers union. Should IU recognize its graduate worker union? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, these are graduate students. After all, is unionizing the right move?
Oh, I think it is, because, you know, anybody who's gone to a large university in recent years knows that, for example, for freshmen and many sophomores, the experience they have is more likely to be with a teaching assistant graduate student than a full professor. I mean, we've underfunded education for higher ed for years, and the result is much more of the burden is being borne by these teaching assistants who are providing a very valuable service to the universities. They're not paid very much at all. They are still charged fees, and in addition to that, they don't have full benefits. So I think it makes perfect sense for them to unionize, and I think IU ought to recognize them.
Should IU recognize this graduate worker union?
I think IU is taking the right position. When you boil this down, this is less than or fewer than 10% of the students who are organizing to try to unionize. And if you look at their packages, so I think on average it's about $50,000 a year. They get free tuition plus a stipend plus benefits. But I think if you dig down deep into what this is about, it's not so much about that as it is other broader things. One of the people who's representing the folks who want to unionize said in this meeting last week, even if you gave us the ideal package and solved all of our problems, we would still be disgruntled and unsatisfied.
Well, that's one person.
Well, it's a representative of the group.
We don't know that at their forum.
I mean, I read it in the newspaper. That's
must be true then.
Well, I assume so. But anyway, so we're talking about really a minority, and there's also an effect here that is for the undergraduates. You've got these folks who are striking, which means they're not going to classes, they're not grading papers, and they're at risk of not getting scores for this semester, which may be what they need to graduate.
You know, if it's
because they're kind of being held captive to this process.
If so it's a small percentage.
If they're lobbying for a bigger package, they should get that. But if the point is not really the package.
Union or bust.
Well, that's what it's looking like.
I don't think that one person exemplifies the entire group. And if it is only 10% of the group, then they won't unionize. I mean, what they have to do is they have to get all the members together and they have to vote for it. And it has to be by majority vote. And if they don't have a majority, then it's going to fail on its own merits.
John, there's been a real surge of unionization across the country in the last couple of years, exemplified over the last few weeks by unionization for the first time in Amazon warehouses, for instance. But this isn't as straightforward as that because they are students. How much does that complicate this issue?
Much. It definitely does. Let me say a couple of things. First, a disclaimer. I have a son who is in the master's program at IU, intelligent systems engineering. Don't know where that came from.
He is a TA.
He's a teaching assistant for two more weeks until he gets his degree. After that, I will tell you what I think about it. But in the meantime, to answer your question about the surge, we've seen a surge not only in the private sector with Amazon and some of these things, but also in higher education. Whether there's some people who say it had to do with COVID and the additional pressures that were placed on graduate students in terms of helping professors through the internet age and dealing with distance learning and these types of things. What we're also seeing is more private institutions are being unionized, and that had to do with a change in administration. It essentially wasn't going to happen under Donald Trump's administration, but Biden has allowed that to happen. So we're seeing Harvard, which is United Auto Workers, incidentally, kind of an odd union to represent one of our most esteemed institutions, but we're seeing others. And there are Big Ten schools, I think, Illinois and maybe Wisconsin, but about 70 some across the country. So it is happening. But for higher education institutions, which are steeped in tradition and the notion of shared governance, which
particularly
is
when it's a public.
They talk about shared institution, the ability to be nimble and the ability to teach. They're worried that it will change the fundamental relationship between full-time faculty and these individuals, making them employees, not students, who are joined in this shared goal of knowledge for knowledge's sake.
Nikki, a similar question to what I asked John, but more from like the public support avenue. Obviously, there are people who support unions and people who don't. And there are, I think, a lot of people in the middle who see something like at Amazon and are like, yeah, Amazon, big company, get them. Does that change when it's something like a public university?
Probably a little bit. I think the sort of monolithic big businessman is one thing versus this. And also, from what I can tell from reading various stories, I mean, IU has been working with the group. They have increased their pay. They've made some concessions. So it's not like they're just, you know,
absolute stalwarts.
At the same time, I think there is a policy that IU has a policy to get a certain number of these cards signed, and then if so, they get an actual vote. And so I haven't been able to see an exact reasoning on why they aren't following that policy.
Yeah. Well, there's perhaps more to come then.
One of the things I think that's important in this, they've raised the salary, and they've raised the salary because the specter of unionization is out there, not necessarily out of the goodness of their hearts. And as long as that specter's there, they will bargain in good faith, and that's a good thing. Because if you can see the pattern of union membership has declined drastically since the 70s, and the middle class, as a result, has shrunk since the 70s. And this is maybe a resurgence of the middle class, which is a good thing.
But universities are fundamentally different. We were talking a moment ago about football teams. We saw the Northwestern University football team try to. Where does it stop? I mean, you have the rowing team.
Well, but you,
that's
you
what the NLRB
have,
is
you
for.
Now have, you also now have NIL, which is a lot of the issues across college
and they're making
sports.
Far more money
top athletes than
they would have ever made in any collective bargaining agreement, one would presume.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. This week's question, should Indiana University recognize its graduate worker union? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked you if Senator Todd Young and Mike Braun would have voted for anyone that President Joe Biden had nominated for the Supreme Court. 7% said Young might have. 0%, I think one vote, said Braun might have. 6% said both might have, and 87% said, not a chance. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Republican challenger's bid to get on the primary ballot against 4th District Congressman Jim Baird was denied in court, as reported recently by based in Lafayette's Dave Bangert. Charles Bookwalter filed to run in the 4th Congressional District Republican primary. That candidacy was challenged by, among others, the vice chair of the Hendricks County Republican Party. That challenge was upheld by the Indiana Election Commission because, as Bookwalter admitted, he did not vote in the 2020 Republican primary. Indiana law says a candidate is affiliated with a party if they voted in at least the last two primaries for that party, or a county chair certifies that they're a member of the party they want to run as. Bookwalter challenged that law, arguing it's unconstitutional, but Marion County Judge Cynthia Ayers disagrees. She ruled against Bookwalter this week in part because, as she writes, the U.S. Supreme Court did not recognize an unfettered right to run for election.
Jennifer Hollowell, this person really had no chance of changing the rule this close to the election, certainly. I think by the time the lawsuit was filed, ballots had already started to go out to overseas voters. But the broader issue here, is the two-primary rule fair?
I think it is. I mean, it is a relatively new rule in the state.
It used to be one primary.
Yeah, this is the first time we're using the two primary rule for the
state races.
That's right.
But there still is an exception that a county party chair can sign off and allow you to be on the ballot. And I mean, the reasoning for this really is if we're going to elect someone or nominate someone to represent a political party, they should probably have demonstrated some dedication to that political party. And so perhaps there may be some reason why you didn't vote in 1 year, and in that, but you're involved, and a county party chairman may sign off and say, absolutely, this person should be allowed to run to represent our party. In this case, the candidate did not vote and opted not to vote in 2020 because he didn't think that there was anything important enough or interesting enough for him to vote on. I take issue with someone wanting to run to represent more than a 500,000 people in the United States Congress who didn't think voting in 2020 was important. There are lots of important races on the ballot every year, and certainly in 2020. So I think it's applied fairly and is upheld at least to this point.
And you're a former party chair. Do you think this, whether it's one primary or two primaries, do you think a rule like that is fair?
Yeah, I do, actually, because we don't register by party. So there has to be some way to indicate that if you want to represent that party in elective office, that you are actually committed to that party. And, I mean, I suppose there are other ways you could do it, but those other ways also can be entertained by the county chair as reason for letting you on the ballot. So, yeah, I think it's fair, and I think it's really, unless we are prepared to register by party, I think it's really the only way to do it.
Nikki, this has been debated a little bit at the State House recently after they passed the law. It's been tried to be repealed unsuccessfully, admittedly by what I think is fair to say fringe elements of the caucus, or not even part of the caucus, really, the Republican caucus. But Representative Curt Neisley and John Jacob have brought up an interesting example, which is a 21-year-old legally cannot have voted in two primaries, and so would not fall under this rule and would then have to ask a county party chair who, on their own whim, might or might not agree to let them run. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's a rough one because they physically can't meet that, you know, rule. Also, I mean, I think we should point out there's nothing in the Indiana Constitution. You know, it says you have to be a certain age. It says you have to live in the district for a year, things like that. And so this is an additional thing we've put on a candidate that is not in the Constitution. So, I mean, you know, I think that's a fair question.
This is that weird intersection between public elections, but private political parties, is it not?
Oh, that's a great example of that. Certainly, it's sort of like license branches used to be
Or
election of county chairs. But I mean, this brings up some interesting issues. Certainly, the age 21 cutoff is one of them. But if you look at Donald Trump, if this law had been in place in New York in 2016, he could not have won. I went back.
That's why I like the law.
He had voted. He had not voted in a number of primaries, and he had voted in a number of Democratic primaries as well. Plus, you have this quirky thing where candidates sometimes encourage their supporters to vote in the other side. So you had Donald Trump, to use him again as an example, who encouraged his supporters in South Carolina during the 2020 cycle. Encourage them to get to vote for Bernie Sanders in South Carolina to cross over and vote. So I guess if they had followed that advice and South Carolina had this, they'd be out of luck. And then lastly, anybody who's concerned I might run for office, you can put your minds at ease, because even though I voted in every general election since age 18, I've never voted in a single primary. So I guess I can't start now.
Yeah.
It just depends on where you live.
Since I've moved to Indiana, when you have to ask for a party ballot, I haven't done the same thing.
But you could vote for school board.
That's true. So, former Indiana State Senator Brent Waltz pleaded guilty this week to criminal charges in a federal investigation that ultimately forced a casino company to give up its control of two major projects in the state. Waltz, a Republican, admitted Monday to taking part in a scheme to direct $40,000 in illegal contributions to his unsuccessful 2016 congressional campaign and making false statements to FBI agents. Waltz was indicted in 2020 with John Keeler, a former top executive of Indianapolis-based Spectacle Entertainment. Keeler is charged with directing illegal corporate contributions to Waltz's campaign. The Indiana Gaming Commission forced the company out of its ownership of projects for new casinos in Gary and Terre Haute. John Schwannis, a lot of people think this whole thing, and it's been going on for a while, isn't done yet. So will it have any further effect on Indiana gaming, which would be the most direct impact, I suppose, to Hoosiers, because that's money to the state?
Sure. You know, We'll see more. Ask next week, and we'll see once the trial for John Keeler gets underway, and we'll see how that sort of shakes out in the early days of that trial. And I know that's a cop-out of an answer, but it's a valid one. Aside from that, I think any time you have so much money at stake, not just with the allegations of, you know, illegal contributions and so forth, but I'm talking about the revenue that's at stake here and how much money can be made or lost, sort of like a casino, I guess, but on a grander scale if you're not the person playing the slots or the tables, but actually the one person, if you're the house.
If you're the house.
And whenever you have that much money involved in any endeavor, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions on casino gaming, there's temptation, and there are humans involved, and people are trying to cut corners. Now, Indiana, as far as we know, has been relatively clean compared to other states, which have had significant problems with corruption associated with casino gaming. So I'm not going to sit here and say this is all that is out there, everything else is pristine. One would assume that sometime in the future, as the industry thrives and grows, that there might be additional challenges.
A lot of people who cover casinos in this state and have followed this case have been, you know, wondering, oh, is there something bigger out there? Is it starting to seem like, I mean, not that this isn't significant, but is this going to be...
I think a lot of people were waiting to see if there were going to be any charges brought against Rod Ratcliffe, who was sort of involved and mentioned a lot, but he's not had anything specifically brought against him. Other than that, I haven't heard of any, you know, talk of a major investigation spreading out into other areas. As far as its impact, it definitely is still happening, because even though we've granted, or the Gaming Commission has granted that license to the new Terre Haute group, that's provisional. There's an ongoing lawsuit going that's all sort of wrapped up in this issue. So, I mean, who knows if that casino could even be built with that license? That is all still up in the air.
And again, that's I mean, because, you know, for instance, the new casino in Gary, the one that had moved, that was transferred away from this company, is still raking in the biggest amount of money for the state since it opened. And that's when you open a new casino, that tends to happen. So this is money to the state that could be held up by this process.
It could be.
How much farther do you think this goes?
Well, I have a fundamental question. I want to know why it was necessary or desirable to give $40,000 illegally and to risk all of this to Brent Waltz, who had one foot out the door in the state Senate at the time he was doing this. Okay, so what had he done for them, or what does he know, is the other question, that would necessitate or would even bring up the possibility of illegally funneling that amount of money in a obviously long-shot congressional race in the first place.
I mean, to that point, I mean, that was a very competitive primary, ultimately won by Trey Hollingsworth, but there were serious, serious candidates in there besides Hollingsworth, including Aaron Houchin, including former Attorney General Greg Zeller. I don't think a lot of people thought Brent Waltz had
a chance
in that primary. So doesn't that part of it seem really odd to you?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, it is interesting. I mean, certainly I think Brent Waltz thought he had a chance in that primary. There were a lot of people through that process, especially early on, before we saw a lot of money coming in from other sides. Everyone had their own kind of analysis of a strategic path that they could win. So I don't know. I wasn't involved in that. I think, we're a long way from potentially knowing if this has any other ramifications. The Gaming Commission, as you mentioned, has taken some actions, and we're just going to have to wait and see.
I mean, Rod Ratcliffe not getting the Terre Haute Casino potentially plays a role in talking about the impact of that. Who knows why the Gaming Commission decided not to give it to him, but you got to wonder if all of this was on their minds. Well, state law requires school districts to give charter schools a chance to lease or buy unused buildings for $1. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Elizabeth Gabriel, reports a lawsuit alleges Carmel Clay Schools did not follow that law.
Carmel Clay Schools closed Orchard Park Elementary at the end of last school year. Now it uses the facility for storage and professional development training. Organizers behind the proposed charter school, Valor Classical Academy, are suing Carmel Clay in Hamilton County Superior Court because they want to use the school building. They allege the district failed to notify the state it would no longer use the facility for instruction. A Carmel Clay spokesperson says they've been fully compliant with the law regarding the use of the building. The Indiana Attorney General's office agrees. It found no violation of the so-called $1 law last year following a complaint about Orchard Park Elementary.
Nikki Kelly, to me, this seems pretty straightforward. The law doesn't say you have to use it for instruction. It just says you have to be using it, and they are technically using it. How soon will that law change?
Gosh, it seems like they are tweaking that law a lot. Like, every year there's another tweak. We saw a big change to it when suddenly there was, IPS had that very, you know, expensive, valuable property for Broad Ripple High School. They wanted to be able to sell it, so there were a lot of changes made there. And I just think that goes to show sort of that there are some issues with the law in the end. If we keep having to change it for every little example that comes up, it's like, you know, that district is still using it. It's not sitting there vacant. It's, you know, I'm sure they argue, well, it's not being used for instruction, but that's not what the law says. So, you know, it just goes to show that that law has been problematic since day one. It continues to be. And every time a new example comes up, we have to chip away and you know, reword the law each time.
Yeah, I mean, how far do Republicans push this law before the public starts to go, hold on now?
Depends on which Republican you're talking about. Some are dedicated to the notion that...
Baining, for example.
Well, you don't need to name names. There are more than one.
It's not hard to name that.
Right. Yeah. But there are people who clearly... It's hard to draw many inference other than the fact that public schools, bad. Private schools, good, in their minds.
Schools are public schools, technically.
Right, but operate without some of the same requirements and so forth. You know, you hear about lawmakers who say the thing about education, it shouldn't be determined by zip code, et cetera, et cetera. It should be a competition, whichever provides the best learning environment, the best result. And yet you tie the hands, potentially, of public schools in terms of funding. We saw a move. It was unsuccessful this session. If there had been a public referendum for funding, that charter schools would have benefited on basically a per capita basis and now we see this kind of thing. It's almost as if you want a unfettered competition to see which one rises, let there be an unfettered competition as opposed to shoring up one of the combatants.
To that point, that's sort of the question I asked Nikki. Is this law going to change to allow this charter school to get that building in Carmel?
Well, first we see what happens with the court case, but then I think if clarification is needed, then yes, I wouldn't be surprised to see that happen in the next session. But I want to reiterate, charter schools are public schools, just like traditional schools are public schools, and taxpayers paid to construct these buildings that traditional public schools are in. And they paid for these school buildings to educate kids for instruction. They didn't pay for the building to be a storage facility, and I don't know the degree of its use. I'm sure that will be discussed, but charter schools are public charter schools are in a different position in that their buildings aren't constructed, and traditional schools buildings were built on property taxes, which charter schools don't have.
Who owns them then?
So taxpayers paid for it for the purpose
of
educating children as
a private entity owns it.
And this is what the debate is about.
You're transferring public money to a private entity is what you're doing.
It is a public charter school.
I understand what it is, but if it closes, okay, where does the property go then?
Well, you can construct that. I don't know the answer.
It goes to the entity that owns the building when it's transferred there. And the other thing is, talk about rising. There is no evidence that students are doing better in charter schools than they are in traditional public schools.
I'm saying that the argument is that it should be.
I know what the argument is, but you ought to have facts behind the argument. Well, they ought to have facts behind the argument before they make it.
All right, finally, a lawsuit in Mississippi is trying to force Republican state lawmakers to give reporters access to their private caucus meetings under the state's open door law, since attorneys argue that the GOP supermajorities are making major decisions behind those closed doors. Nikki Kelly, how badly do you wish Indiana's open door law didn't specifically exempt caucuses?
Oh, so, so badly. I would just sit there with the popcorn, you know, like the GIF, and just, because we don't hear any of those debates on the floor. All of that is hashed out behind closed doors.
I mean, that comes to a amendments that are offered or not offered and all of that. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, every lawmaker will tell you they hate caucus meetings and that it's not as exciting as we all think it is.
But they won't let us come.
I think just once, just let us in. Yeah. All right. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Have a happy holiday weekend to everyone who is celebrating their holidays. Stay safe, stay healthy. Please get vaccinated if you can, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.